Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the CAP Action Press conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the conference over to Tara McGinnis. Ms. McGinnis, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on today's call. I just want to remind everyone that this call is being recorded. I'm Tara McGinnis. I'm a Senior Vice President for CAP Action. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that Obamacare is constitutional, and we've had a new discussion about all of the benefits of the health law that is going to be impacting millions of people, creating access for health insurance for 30 million Americans and lowering premiums, making investments in preventive care and women's health, allowing young kids to stay on their parents' insurance, and providing discounts for seniors for brand name drugs. But quickly, the conversation has moved off the policy benefits of the law and its implementation process and shifted back to the political arena. So we thought that we would host a briefing today to talk about exactly how a very similar law worked in Massachusetts. I'm joined today by Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley and MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who will speak about RomneyCare and how it was successfully implemented in Massachusetts and how these policies actually became a model for the Affordable Care Act. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley.
Thank you, Tara. I am delighted to be here, and I just want to say, having discussed this and having lived through the implementation of our statute in Massachusetts, we've made it a point of trying to show people not only do you not need to be concerned about the national legislation, in fact, you can look to Massachusetts to understand why you don't need to be concerned and, in fact, why it is a good thing for states, and now with this statute being termed constitutional, to try and implement it. And I think to put it in perspective, you know, Massachusetts back in 04, 05 had the problem that many of the states and the country has. Healthcare is expensive, but we wanted choice and we wanted access. So how do we solve that problem? And I think it's important to put it in this perspective, that Massachusetts didn't spend a lot of time saying, oh, this may be unconstitutional or this will be something else. But we focused on how could we devise an apparatus that would allow Massachusetts, with its large not-for-profit center, its business community, its elected officials, to solve that problem of providing access, choice, and quality. And frankly, what we came up with was what is the model for the national legislation, with the help, of course, of Governor Romney and many experts in healthcare who said, first, let's get everybody insured because that's important. When everybody is in the pool, we then have the universe of both what the needs are going to be, and we can look at that, and also make sure that people who can afford health insurance but choose not to do it, even though they are using health care, will be sharing their fair part of the cost. And it was key at that time to understand that the individual responsibility that people would have to pay for costs in a healthcare system in which they participated. Remember, you know, 99% of people are born in a hospital. Everybody uses healthcare. So this idea that we could do this resulted in the implementation of something in Massachusetts that looks very similar to what the national legislation has been. And it means that 98% or more of our citizens are covered. All of our children are covered. We have, of course, as everybody deals with healthcare costs, but we have tackled that now to try and keep costs down. And our role, as in the Attorney General's office, has been looking at the markets and looking at how we solve this problem. And I just think this is key to understand that everybody will say we should have insurance, we should have good healthcare, we should have access to it. It's important for the country. It's important for people in every state. And so let's focus on solving that problem. And conversely, when people start throwing out unreasonable costs or unfairness or all of the parade of horribles, as our governor said, they did not happen here. They haven't happened here. And we have worked very hard and continue to work with all elements who have an interest in resolving these issues that are important. And I am hopeful that people will look at facts and not be frightened by predictions that haven't proven to be true here in Massachusetts and will not be true if people are honest and are focused on the problem-solving piece of trying to get access to and quality health care for people in this country, including, for instance, focusing on prevention, keeping costs down, making sure that people get the care they need before it becomes more expensive or before it becomes less effective. All of these issues that have been raised are, frankly, I believe, red herrings about how something could go wrong. And if people are determined to not implement health care because they raise these red herrings, then I think that their motivation should be questioned. I think we should be looking at, as I said to my colleagues, attorneys general across the country, let's focus on solving these problems. Look at what Massachusetts has done. We've been very successful at doing it. Other states can. They are given leeway in this statute to do it. And those who continue to argue about old arguments now, as of yesterday, are not focused, I think, in the best interest of the public they should be serving.
Talk a little bit more about how this worked.
So should I go now?
Sure.
Okay, so this is John Gruber, and Attorney General Coakley spoke very eloquently on a variety of topics, and I just want to emphasize two things, reemphasize two things she said. The first thing I want to emphasize is that we have an empirical basis for understanding how the Affordable Care Act will work. Okay, this is a rare example of where a laboratory of democracy has spoken. In Massachusetts, we've run the experiment. It has succeeded. We've covered two-thirds of our uninsured citizens. We have raised private health insurance coverage. We're the only state, one of the only states in the nation where employer-sponsored health insurance actually went up instead of down in this recession. We have done so with broad public support of about two-thirds, and we fixed a broken non-group health insurance market, lowering our premiums by more than half. The facts are in, and they speak very clearly. Okay. Now, what we haven't done in Massachusetts yet is we haven't controlled health care costs. Now, I like to say that criticizing Massachusetts for not controlling health care costs, because criticizing our law for not controlling health care costs is kind of like criticizing the Red Sox for not winning the Super Bowl. Okay, it wasn't the goal of our law in 2006, and it didn't achieve that goal because it wasn't the goal. But it has led to what we're doing now, and Attorney General Coakley and others have led, which is an ambitious new effort to control health care costs. And so coverage inspired efforts to control health care costs, and that's all going to happen at the national level as well. The first thing is to look to what we did in Massachusetts and recognize the evidence. And importantly, coming to the decision yesterday in the specifics, recognize that this is not a broad new tax on the middle class, as some people have randomly been throwing out there. We have less than 1% of our population, about 44,000 people out of 6 million, are paying the penalty this year. They're paying $1,200 because they would prefer to pay that instead of having health insurance. And that's their choice. You know, it's America. Let them have that choice. That's what we do. If they decide they want to pay the penalty instead of having health insurance, they're allowed to do that. It's not a tax on the middle class. It's a choice they're making that they would rather stay out of the medical care system and pay the cost of their doing so. Because let's be clear, as Governor Romney emphasized back in 2005, if you do not have health insurance, you are free riding on the system. Because what you're doing without health insurance is you're relying on the emergency room for your care. And when you go to the emergency room and get that care, then you cost the rest of the system money. So what we impose is say, look, that is fine if you want to make that choice, but you need to compensate society for the cost you're imposing. That's what this penalty does, and that's what it does at the national level. Once again, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that about 1% of the population will end up paying this penalty. This is not a broad new tax on the middle class. It is trivial. It is CBO estimates $4 billion in revenues from this penalty. That is trivial relative to the almost $100 billion that you would get in once it's phased in new tax credits to individuals to buy health insurance. So this is on net an enormous tax cut for the middle class. This is not a tax increase. The other thing I just want to emphasize that, you know, Attorney General Coakley mentioned as well is, I just can't emphasize enough to the press, just please, please look to the facts on this. Please do not be thrown off by the misleading contentions that are made by opponents of this law. The truth is the facts are clear. We have seen it in Massachusetts. It's clear how the law works. You have a lot of experts out there who are willing to tell you what the facts are objectively, including the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan objective body. Let's rely on the facts and not on the lies of opponents to the law.
Thanks very much. I want to, at this time, open it up to questions from the press before I make any final remarks. It'll take a minute for questions to come through the line.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of David Abel.
Hear me?
Hello? Yes.
Yep. Hi, it's David Abel from the Boston Globe. So my question is whether when you were designing Romneycare and then Obamacare, did you envision legal attack as it came in the form of the ultimate Supreme Court appeals, and what did you do to sort of try to defend the law from potential legal attacks?
You know, Attorney General Coakley is the lawyer, but let me just say from the experience of having sort of written Romneycare and then Obamacare, this was always viewed as sort of a nuisance argument, that basically when we crafted this law, we agreed with the vast majority of constitutional scholars that this is permissible under the Commerce Clause. Look, just 2 days before the Supreme Court decision, they polled 21 constitutional scholars, 19 of which said that this was completely permissible under the Commerce Clause. And that was the perspective we took, that this is completely constitutional. It's sort of a nuisance argument. And I was quite frankly stunned it got as far as it did.
And I became Attorney General in 2007. At that stage, obviously, the law had been implemented, and there were no challenges. There may have been one insignificant challenge to one portion of the law, but in my memory, at least at the state level, this was not raised either as a legal or factual concerns. Certainly in putting it together, and again, with a bipartisan group led by Governor Romney, this was the conservative way to have individual responsibility for paying for health care that people knew they were going to use or had used already. And so it was putting everybody in the pool. The focus was on making it work. And as we came in 2007, we started a health care division because we knew there would be huge issues with keeping costs down. Again, as Johnson pointed out, we did this partly to address costs and make sure we could do it more successfully. And anyone who says that our health care law has caused costs to rise is just wrong. That is incorrect. We are making progress in keeping costs down because we've got the framework with our health care reform to look at the way the market works and how contracts are and how we should be paying to the fee-for-service is looking at prevention and doing global payments. But this idea that somehow it could be challenged is relatively recent. It was not true at the time that we were passing law in Massachusetts, and to my recollection, it was not a major issue as a legal issue at the time healthcare was being debated in Congress. The focus was on the policy and whether people liked it or not, not on the legality of it.
Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Hillary Chavez.
Hi there. For the Attorney General, but also Jonathan Groomer, if you want to weigh in, just if you could talk a little bit about how you square that this is not a tax when the Supreme Court basically sort of upheld this as constitutional, saying tax.
Hillary, I'm sorry. Could you
Could you repeat it?
That would be great.
So I'm wondering if you can just sort of explain how you square that this isn't a tax, or explain that this isn't a tax when the Supreme Court seemed to, first of all, disregard the Commerce Clause and, in fact, ruled it constitutional under basically by saying that this was a tax.
Well, first of all, it's important to know that the the thrust of the decision, obviously, was that it was constitutional. The Chief Justice and the other justices joined that decision that Justice Roberts wrote, but four of the others clearly talked about the constitutionality under the original framework and the primary way in which it had been justified. And I do think that even though Chief Justice Roberts' decision talks in general about a taxing authority that Congress has, calling it one thing or another is frankly a red herring. I think that it is not significant now when you look at the facts about what this means. It is really a cost that is imposed on somebody who decides, and people can choose to be in the pool and participate or not, and if they choose not to, no one makes them buy insurance, they choose not to, there is a cost associated with that. There is a penalty, which is what we do in Massachusetts. As Jonathan Gruber just pointed out, it's under 1% of people who make that choice, but they have the choice to do it. It's not any kind of a general imposition of that, and it is something that is a regulatory scheme, a regulatory apparatus that lets us do the problem solving that we wanted to do in Massachusetts. The Supreme Court has clearly said Congress has the authority to do this, and so I just think it's insignificant, irrelevant at this stage of the game as to what we call it. It is about how do we get at what is the really important issue of getting people insured, getting everybody who can and should be paying their fair share, taking their individual responsibility for paying for health care, and making sure that we, as we're doing in Massachusetts, keep costs down while we look at health care choice and quality.
Mr. Gruber, I'm just curious because, I mean, you were talking about how the vast majority feel this is constitutional under the Commerce Clause. I mean, any sense as to why, in the end, it was sort of the tax aspect that ended up allowing it to remain constitutional?
I wish I knew. I mean, I think this was really considered, as Attorney General Coakley said, I'll be blunter than she was, I think this was considered sort of a fringe legal argument until very, very recently.
Right.
It's sort of stunning that the Supreme Court seems to have disagreed with such a large share of experts in the area. But look, all's well that ends well. The main headline is the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. And, you know, opponents of the bill are trying to get into semantics out of their desperation to try to mischaracterize the bill. Look, at the end of the day, the way the law works is clear. You can either have health insurance or you can pay a penalty that offsets the cost to society if you're not having health insurance. Now, let's be clear about the way this works with the mandate, because I think there's a lot of misinformation. First of all, there's no effect on you if you already have health insurance. And, in fact, if you poll citizens and you ask them what they think of the mandate, only about 33% like it. But if you then explain to them that you're not subject to any mandate penalty if you already have health insurance, that support goes up to 60%. People just need to understand this. The second thing to understand is you are not subject to a mandate penalty if you cannot afford health insurance. There's no mandate penalty on our lowest-income citizens. And there's no mandate penalty on anyone who cannot find health insurance for less than 8% of their income. It's only that range of people who can afford health insurance but choose to stay out of the system. They pay this free rider penalty, which was, as I said, Governor Romney's original idea.
I think we have time for one more question.
Your next question comes from the line of Merrill Gisner from Fiscal Times.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. John, I think this is for you. A lot of pressure is going to come now on Mitt Romney to come up with an alternative for this campaign. And I'm curious, just as a historical note, when Massachusetts was debating its developing its health care reform law under Governor Romney, were there any discussions about alternative models using the exchange and the ideas that eventually became embodied in what you're calling Romney Care?
You know, that's a good question, Merrill. I think that in the larger scope, there wasn't really discussion of alternatives. I mean, no one was talking single payer or no one was talking something just a Medicaid expansion. I mean, the basic structure was what was discussed the whole time. But there were a huge amount of details that were debated, in particular, whether to have the individual mandate was a decision. You know, we considered both plans, both with and without the mandate, how generous to make the subsidies, things like that. Those were all debated. But the basic structure was this kind of, I really think, truly innovative sort of third-way structure of trying to do what I've called incremental universalism, sort of build on the system that works, but get to universal coverage. And it was a realization this was a great way to do it.
So just a quick follow-up. One of the ideas, you know, that have, you know, the idea of premium support, vouchers, a lot of the things that we'll probably start hearing a lot more about, he never brought that to the table during the debate?
Once again, that's really, you know, in some sense, want to step back and say the larger issue is, should consumers have choice across their health insurance plan? Okay, that was a basic fundamental notion behind his plan. And that was behind both Romney Care and Obamacare, the notion of setting up exchanges and giving consumers increased choice, especially small businesses and individuals who don't face a competitive market with many choices right now. Now, premium support you can think of as a way of applying those principles to Medicare. So it wasn't really part of our debate because we weren't really debating Medicare. Now, whether that's a good idea or not should be the point of another conversation. There's a lot of problems with that. But I think that's really sort of a separate topic. It's about whether you apply this topic of choice, which was really the model followed by both Romney Care and Obamacare, whether you take that and apply it to existing social insurance programs.
I want to thank everyone for joining us today. This is Tara McGinnis from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and I want to, before we wrap it up, make one final point about the politics of this policy. You know, for years now, the opponents of the bill have been assaulting what is now the health care law for its lack of constitutional credibility. Yesterday, those questions were put to rest and are over. Now there are new reasons for why the health care law cannot move on and be implemented. They're disguised in some of the tax attacks that were described. But there's real peril in this assault. As Republicans take a punch at the provision of the health care law, you know, aimed at President Obama, it appears that their attacks could land on Mitt Romney, who very clearly made the case for this policy in Massachusetts. I want to thank everyone for joining us. If there are any more questions that you have, you can contact us. You can contact me or Katie Peters, kpeters, P-E-T-E-R-S-1, at AmericanProgressAction.org. That's AmericanProgressAction.org. Thank you very much, and thank you very much to our speakers.
Thank you.
Thanks.